Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 49 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the non-fiction writer Annette Kobach considers the lessons that other art forms might provide to the practicing writer, including suggestions from her own experiences as a writer and painter. Here she is with Artful Writing.
Did you hear Daniel Barenboim explaining a few years ago in his Wreath lectures how he gauges the precise moment to break into the silence of the concert hall with his first piano notes? He does it, he said, by imagining the music is already there, pre-existing, and that he's just joining it, or as he put it, just stepping on a train that's already in motion. When I heard that, I realised what a helpful concept that was for writing, for that often problematic opening sentence of a book. And as a mini homage to Barenboim, you may have noticed, I've stepped into this essay in that spirit. So, as a writer, instead of facing a blank page and your first marks on it, you slip into the world you're conjuring up midstream, rather as Lawrence Stern famously does in Tristram Shandy. I wish, the book starts, either my father or my mother, or indeed both of them, had minded what they were about when they begot me. We're joining Shandy's up-and-running world without fanfare or preamble, almost on an offbeat. Like many people in the arts, I find it helpful to take ideas about strategies in writing from an art form other than my own like this. Not that I don't love reading writers' thoughts on the process and pitfalls of writing. To a fault, I do. From Montaigne to Emma Forster, Dorothea Brand to Stephen King, from David Lodge or Ray Bradbury and all the Paris Review interviews, up to the whole proliferating and often repetitive world of blogs on how to write. To a fault, I say, because it can be another all too seductive displacement activity, another sharpening of the pencils. And while it's consoling to read of writers like Norman Mailer or Hanif Qureshi encountering the same troughs as we have, it can compound the problem and angst for us as writers, locked in our studies and our thoughts with no way out but words. So sometimes other art forms offer just the right jolts and practical insights, just the sturdy artisan's tips that move things on and expand our worlds. For me, it's art rather than music that usually does this. That's partly because I've taken up this old love again as a practitioner, as we now say of any art form. And it's partly because I find some technical aspects of art so applicable to writing. It may seem counterintuitive for a non-fiction writer, which I mainly am, to find the practice of art helpful. Indeed, the great non-fiction writer Peter Matheson thought non-fiction and art quite self-evidently had nothing in common. As he told the Paris Review at the end of last century, non-fiction at its best is like fashioning a cabinet. It can never be sculpture. It can be elegant and very beautiful, but it can never be sculpture. Captive to facts or predetermined forms, it cannot fly. Of course, we know what he means, and it seems obvious, especially that non-fiction cannot fly. But I disagree with him. Yes, non-fiction is captive to facts, which is why many of us love it. But for a start, it's no longer captive to predetermined forms. New technologies like interactive texts are changing that, and more agile forms of non-fiction are evolving to mirror our less linear cradle-to-grave lives. Non-fiction, as we well know, is also getting plundered and reshaped by all manner of arts and artists, from film to Turner Prize winners, not to mention that the facts themselves can be notoriously slippery. They can be changed, for example, even in the juxtaposition of one fact to another. Just as the juxtaposition of one down-at-heel, apologetic-looking boot in Van Gogh's famous painting, alongside a more upright boot, changes the mood and the meaning of a pair of boots. In fact, you could almost say that Van Gogh himself, in one of his poignant letters to his brother Theo, the sturdy boot to his downtrodden one, prefigures in another key Barenboim's point about how and when to come in with your music, with your art, with your words. Writing about what he calls that trouble one has at the beginning of a work, but also of a working life, he notes how it sometimes gives an awkwardness to the studies. He feels this comes from being conscious of a nervousness and a certain dryness, which is the exact opposite of the calm, broad touch one strives for. And yet it doesn't work well if one applies oneself too much to acquiring that broadness of touch. When, Van Gogh says, he has that feeling of nervous unrest and agitation, as he puts it, the oppression as on summer days before a thunderstorm, then, he says, I change my work just to make a new start. What he and Barenboim are both saying is simple and similar and quite zen, which Peter Matheson might have appreciated, that it can be a good tactic to let go of everything you know at the start, however much you know, to shift a gear and bowl lightly into what you're doing. How consoling it is that a loose-limbed genius like Van Gogh wrestled sometimes with awkwardness in starting a work and took measures to sidestep it. It's perhaps because the productive to-and-fro between the craft necessary to shape a piece of work and the artlessness necessary to make it live, to make it fly, is most concrete in art that it throws up such good tactics. Matisse, for example, is talking about just that interplay between keeping the quick of life in play and yet keeping some form, some shape around it, when he speaks of picking a bunch of flowers. He says to his friend Renoir that once he's picked and arranged them, he finds he's lost something. Renoir agrees and has a solution. When I arrange a bouquet to paint it, he says, I turn it to the side I hadn't been looking at. A simple manoeuvre, this, within the seemingly old-fashioned context of flower painting, but its essence applies to most artworks, not to mention to life. How do you balance spontaneity and control? Renoir and Matisse, in turn, are echoing Van Gogh. Shift the point of view if something you're working on is getting too arranged, too contrived. All this is perfectly transposable to writing. Points of view being as much part of the writer's core repertoire as they are of the artist's. Both art and writing, after all, are involved in the same activity, creating three-dimensional worlds out of nothing, starting on some kind of blank page. Even the primary material can be seen as common to both. Simply attention, that quality and degree of attention you give to what has caught your eye or mind or your imagination. As Henry James put it, try to be the kind of person on whom nothing is lost. Both art and writing typically capture that attention in notebooks and sketchbooks, accumulating scraps with no particular agenda. My future writing compost for who knows what includes an ever-growing list of Sydney Morning Herald headlines. They range from the almost poetic croc clamps jaws on cop's head to the impressively explicit woman, 91, killed while hanging out washing after being pinned against garage wall by a car driven by a friend. Or the full-blown heroic, Dorothea, 85, stops moose stomping on husband. I find artists' habits and attitudes in keeping their sketchbooks instructive, in keeping a writing notebook. They value but don't over-control their material, making the books tactile and sensuous objects in themselves while not being too precious about them. Dud pages are kept in on principle, cheek by jowl with good ones, and a seemingly perfect drawing overdrawn by something else. Once committed to making an artwork, though, the tables are turned. A little formality and boundary making are in order. It's a common practice, in painting, for example, to make a pencil or tape frame around the edge of a blank paper or canvas before beginning a picture. With writing, such a framing device can also serve to contain massing initial thoughts within some simple structure to stop them getting out of hand at the start. This can be anything from setting up files with working titles for parts or chapters of a book, colour-coded perhaps for research, chronology, drafts, thank you, Mr. Jobs, to imagining the actual look of the book you're starting, its front cover, design, its title, your name on it, the fonts. Sometimes this process can even throw up a title. Of course, as with painting, your work may end up spilling over its boundaries altogether or changing tack. The framework isn't there to limit you, but to give reassuring signposts to your subconscious about your serious intentions. With painting, the bonus is that you have a payoff when you finish, that satisfying moment when you strip off the tape and reveal the crisp edge which offsets your work. And similar ta-da moments in writing when clicking on the word length and finding you're hitting it. Thanks again, Mr. Jobs. Or when you suddenly see your way to an unexpected final sentence and realise you are home and reasonably dry. Another common tactic artists are taught is to look for the spaces in between what they perceive. So, not the yellow chair and the yellow bed themselves, but what our eyes are used to occluding, the pulsing wall, the springy floorboards in between. Van Gogh does this in painting, as do any number of contemporary artists in different ways. And Richard Ford, for example, does it in writing, revealing the life in the usually invisible and overlooked dark matter that connects objects and, most of all, people. Emotional states can, of course, for artists and writers, be very much part of that dark matter. Is this too obscure to apply to non-fiction? I think not. The impetus for my book about my Czechoslovak father, for instance, called Joe's War, My Father Decoded, came, apart from other emotional spurs, from just that impulse to look at something overlooked, something in between, the central European experience of the Second World War. To my amazement, none of the major historians of the Second World War had brought in the Polish points of view or narrative. Particularly, and as I found out extremely tellingly, Winston Churchill. I found, just as a writer like Lionel Shriver or an artist like Grayson Perry have found, that opening up ignored or taboo areas releases stores of creative energy. There's another useful artistic tactic, which the artist Ronnie Horne wrote about as a breakthrough point for her work, and it's very simple. By having two things as your subject in a painting rather than one, you create a force field between them which is more dynamic than a single subject. In retrospect, I can see that I used a similar principle in Joe's War. By making a parallel journey to my father's across the Carpathian Mountains for the book, as I did, and then splicing the two journeys together, I created a charge and a conversation between our eras and our two selves, that was more potent, at least to me, than simply describing his journey at the arm's length of 50 years. Do these connections seem too obscure, too personal, or even too obvious to you? If so, I'll offer you a random bouquet, in the spirit of Matisse and Renoir, of practical painting tips that have excited me with their parallels to writing. I leave it to you to imagine if and how they could be applicable to your own work, and therefore stealable in Picasso's well-known formulation. First, it's a good idea to allow for a sacrificial quarter of an hour or so at the beginning of the working day, warming up with something connected to your work. Allow for some faffing, some sharpening of pencils, some drawing with the left hand, as it were. This particularly applies if there's a tight deadline. As Garrison Keillor put it, deadline, then slow down. Secondly, think layers. The old masters created paintings in layers, invariably with the darkest colours first, starting with black. Black itself was and still is best made with, for example, lemon yellow, alizarin crimson, and Prussian blue, rather than straight from the black tube. Lemon yellow in black? Who'd have thought? In the same way, the richest and darkest villains in literature, the Satans, the Richard the Thirds, have many hues to them. By putting the darkest areas in first, you give yourself an overall pattern and the confidence that subsequent layers, ending with any highlights and lines, will work at their best against them. Thirdly, when painting a portrait, it's good, I've learnt, if entirely counterintuitive, to paint a layer of blue under the flesh colour. This, rather nicely, is because of the blood veins under our skin. Our underlying colour is blue, not even red, which you might think of for blood. Think Lucian Freud. And an additional tip in portrait painting is to determine which direction the eyes are looking, even what they're looking at, which may be out of the picture. This resonates in non-fiction for me. I cracked my biography of Isabel Eberhardt the moment I began looking at the world out of her eyes, as if I were inside her head looking out. And then, a random tip, watch out for magenta as a colour. It dominates, and it also stains. Use it sparingly and judiciously, as you would an exclamation mark. Finally, the ribbon around the bouquet, a wonderful end moment in oil painting, akin to ripping off the tape around the canvas, is putting the glazes in. Boy, do they pull things together. But master painters say never put white into a glaze because it makes things too chalky, which is why yellow ochre is bad for a glaze, as it has too much white in it. And importantly, don't be tempted to overglaze at the end. And it is very tempting to overglaze, to smooth everything out, to gloss over the bits that don't quite gel. Does that sound familiar with writing? To overglaze a sentence, tidying it up just that bit too much on the surface to give the appearance of coherence without fully addressing why it doesn't hang together. And as a coda, a personal cameo of how painting is throwing a light for me on what I'm currently writing, which is a book around the French writer Germaine de Staël, which also incorporates a parallel journey as Joe's War did. For a painting exercise, I'd copied an old portrait of a man in a black hat, the oldest painting in Tate Britain's collection, as it happens. I'd made a Xerox copy of it to work from, but my printer had run out of some of the colours, so it came out askew. The black hat and brown fur coat turned cobalt blue. I liked the weirdness and worked with it. As Francis Bacon, the painter, said, you hope chance is going to work in your favour. But what I discovered most of all was that while I loved doing a detailed Holbein-esque drawing of the face, for the rest of the painting I wanted something much looser, all about colour and brushstrokes. And I discovered that different techniques can combine, and often do now, within the same painting or work. We could say that this fragmenting mirrors the different wavelengths within a modern day, or even hour. But we could also call this perfectly 16th century, with the master attending to the portrait with a more polished technique than the maybe more slapdash apprentice who's left with the robes and the hands in the background. All this made me realise that I get excited by the minute particulars of my subject's life, which is why, for me, the lines of historical fiction are too blurred, but don't want to carry the style through to the whole painting. I want Holbein with a 21st century twist, an insight which only an image could have given me. That cross-fertilisation between art and writing has always gone the other way too, of course, as with Hockney drawing on Cavafy, or Wallace Stevens, or Van Gogh on Hugo, Zola, Balzac, Dickens, Shakespeare, and many more. As Van Gogh puts it, there is something of Rembrandt in Shakespeare, and of Delacroix in Victor Hugo. It comes to the same, if only one understands the thing in the right way. You see, he writes to Theo, there are many things which one must believe and love, and he urges him to admit that the love of books is as sacred as the love of Rembrandt, and I even think the two complete each other. But one must learn to read exactly as one must learn to see and learn to live. How helpful it is in the everyday isolation of writing to know one's joining a conversation, a train of thought, that's already bowling along.
That was Annette Kobach. You can find out more about Annette on the RLF website. Her surname is spelt K-O-B-A-K. And that concludes episode 49, which was recorded by Carol Angier and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 50, the poet Ian Duhigg considers the long-standing and rich interaction between poetry and traditional forms of music, and the biographer and journalist Caroline Moorhead describes her experiences in researching the French Resistance. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.